Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Last week, I provided a brief introduction to dependent co-arising as the most comprehensive and profound of the Buddha's teachings. Unfortunately, it has been historically poorly understood. Today, I want to begin at one end of the 12-link chain with the problem of human suffering. The Buddha described this link as follows. Because of birth, aging, and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair arise. Thus does this entire mass of sufferings arising come to be. The very first two verses of the Dhammapada also refers to suffering as well and sets the broad perspective in which dependent co-arising is to be understood. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of an ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows, like a never departing shadow. Most of us experience the world as a given, something external to ourselves, but on which our well-being depends. The world is in fact mind-constructed. In our ignorance, we presume it to be one way, but we can presume it to be otherwise, or not presume at all. Mind is malleable, and how we live our lives of practice make it either corrupted or peaceful. With a corrupted mind, the world is suffering. With a peaceful mind, it is beyond suffering. Buddhism begins with the human condition. Life is persistently experienced as a problem, if not as downright painful. This is the very point at which Buddhism diverges from most other religions, in which, as William James put it, we are saved from the wrongness by making proper connection with the higher powers. In Buddhism, in contrast, we seek the resolution of suffering very much within the range of human capabilities. Suffering is something we humans do to ourselves, and by golly, we can just as well do something about it. Instead of expecting to be lifted out of suffering from on high, Buddhists scramble out of suffering, or rather systematically disentangle ourselves from its grip. Suffering is the most common translation of the Pali word dukkha, most commonly occurring as an adjective. So we will also translate dukkha as painful. Stress, dissatisfaction, unpleasantness, and dis-ease are alternative translations. There's no exact equivalent in English, for it covers everything from mild anxiety to excruciating agony, either physical or mental. The opposite of dukkha is sukha, pleasantness or happy. The Buddha saw our suffering as a human condition, as something we do perpetually to ourselves, and that we can learn to stop doing by ourselves, if we can just work how we are doing it in the first place. The purpose of dependent co-arising is to address this condition. So do the Four Noble Truths, but in two links, not 12. The 12 links of dependent co-arising are a summary of a more detailed teaching on what goes on in between, before and after and around those two links to ensnarl ourselves in this entire mass of suffering, and how we release ourselves knot by knot. in the next couple of talks, we begin to understand the nature of this entire mass of suffering and then outline how we will proceed to peel back one layer of conditionality after another in the rest of this long series of talks, much as the Buddha reports having done in his original discovery of dependent co-arising. Here are some examples of suffering. Birth is painful, old age is painful, illness is painful, death is painful, sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress are painful. Association with the disliked is painful. Separation from the liked is painful. Not getting what you wish for is painful. In brief, the five aggregates of appropriation are painful. The five aggregates, or khanda, and the five aggregates of appropriation, upadana khanda, mentioned here, are recurring concepts in the EBT, the early Buddhist texts, and associated with various factors of dependent co-arising. Here we encounter the aggregates for the first time. Very briefly, the five aggregates refer to the world as we experience it, and the five aggregates of appropriation refer to our personal footprint, everything we choose to have a stake in within that world. We will clarify this in the course of this long series of talks. The passage therefore identifies our personal footprint within the range of suffering. It is a world of pain. Not only is life marked by the suffering of sickness, old age, and death, but with little difficulty we manage to generate suffering for ourselves in between these events. For instance, in the course of our lives, we begin to build up stature, to become somebody. We hope somebody with money and influence. Then, when we thought we would feel happy with what we have become, we instead feel all the more threatened, for we now have more to lose, and therefore more to protect than before. And out of becoming someone comes self-image and pride in that self-image, which restricts our options by removing our willingness to step beyond our self-image and makes us fragilely vulnerable to circumstances like verbal assault. Gain obsesses the mind and loss obsesses the mind. Fame obsesses his mind and disrepute obsesses his mind. Blame obsesses his mind and praise obsesses his mind. Pleasure obsesses his mind, and pain obsesses his mind. He's attracted to gain and repelled by loss. He's attracted to fame and repelled by disrepute. He's attracted to praise and repelled by blame. He's attracted to pleasure and repelled by pain. Thus involved with attraction and repulsion, he's not freed from birth, from old age and death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and anguish. He's not freed from suffering, I say. If we are a person of means, we have wealth in the stock market but fear a downturn. We have a shiny new car but fear a scratch. Or imagine hot wiring hoodlums. We enjoy prestige but fear the gossiping voices that suddenly become quiet as we enter the room. We boast a yacht but fear the hurricane. The more means we are a person of, the more threats we fear, and we try to counter these with an even larger portfolio, a two-car garage, a more loyal network of friends, insurance policies, a position of even more authority. Feeling decreasingly secure, we've been slurped up into a vortex of ever greater pain and threat. The individual identity we have carefully nurtured dissolves under constant attack, and we suffer from nagging doubt about our ultimate worth, as if we can be swept away from the world at any moment and never missed. Moreover, if we are a person of little means, we fare no better. For we long for the very means that vex the person of means, perpetually living like a person of means who has just lost his means. All of this weighs heavily on our emotional health as well as on our physical well-being. Stress and anxiety turn to sleeplessness, to panic attacks, to addiction. Headaches, ulcers, persistent back problems, high blood pressure, heart disease arise from our entanglement. Our very appearance is shaped by our turmoil, as our youth and beauty are prematurely sacrificed and our lives shortened. We begin to divide the world into good and evil, extending outwards from what we personally like and what we dislike, what is reassuring and what is threatening, what is an instrument for us and what is an obstacle, who likes us and who dislikes us. There is a me at the center of a network of causality that includes these other elements, good and evil and so on, and little else. We become indifferent to that part of the world that has become irrelevant to our personal interests. We share our distorted sense of reality with others, or perhaps absorb it from others, as we form allegiances and spread infectious gossip. Shared within our clique, this reality becomes ever more exaggerated, and inevitably its biases and prejudices end up violating and angering other groups. In our neediness and lack, we learn to scheme, to present ourselves favorably, to exhaust ourselves at work, to eliminate competition, sometimes to steal or lie, whatever we think it takes to satisfy our needs. Our greed and aversion entangle us more and more in a web of unskillful impulses and habits, and ensnarl others in the same as others try to compete with our greed, lest we take what they have or might want. Or else they try to compete with our anger in self-defense, then seek vengeance when our plans are most fruitful. Envy, resentment at the injustice, stealing a client, angry words, as our greed robs and impoverishes others, and our fear and insecurity turns to hate and arouses fear in ourselves, as the world conspires to bring down what we have accomplished, and all the while our search for personal advantage sets a poor example for others, destroys trust and ideals, and turns others' reserves of noble intentions, along with our own, to cynicism. Worse, we regard others as instruments of our own personal advantage. We love, and while briefly rousing, there is no peace to be gained. Either we stop or they stop, and it turns to tragedy, sometimes hatred, depression, suicide, murder. And what of the pleasures of life? As children, we are the explorers of the wonders of it all. For a while, it even seems, the world is a candy shop of delicious sights, sounds, and tastes that we want to make our own. We begin a life of toys, electronic gadgets, later power tools, fast cars, fast women, fast food. From a young age, our consumer culture with its relentless marketing of stuff cheers us on. Yet personal neediness is never satisfied even by abundance, and the shadow side of this is a feeling of lack, perpetual dissatisfaction, discontent, that we just cannot shake. As the Buddha warns, not even with a shower of gold coins would we find satisfaction in sensual craving. Still, we distract ourselves with parties, games, public entertainment, and private sexual intrigue. There is enthusiasm, laughter, thrills, but there is always tension underneath. We get fat and drink too often, zone out in front of the tube, and still we cannot wash away the sense of lack. Furthermore, our suffering is fueled by misperception, by the stories we wrap around things. We, like children, can hardly be expected to foresee the scope of the tragic losses that are yet to come and the relentless decay that will bring us ever closer to death. However, one by one, we see that what we are trying to hang on to is swept away. One by one, everyone we love is swept away. Our very bodies deteriorate. We realize that life is like trying to hold a handful of sand and watching it run through our fingers, and we have no way to cope with that realization. Life, we discover, is an unbroken series of broken promises. We humans tend habitually to turn our experience towards suffering at all levels, beginning with the input from our senses. Bhikkhus, all is burning, and what bhikkhus is the all that is burning? The eye is burning, appearances are burning, eye cognizance is burning, eye contact is burning, and whatever feeling arises with eye contact as condition, whether pleasant or painful or neither painful nor pleasant, that too is burning. Burning with what? Burning with the fire of lust, with the fire of hatred, with the fire of delusion, burning with birth, aging, and death, with sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair, I say. And the Buddha goes on to describe how also the ear is burning, the nose is burning, the tongue is burning, the body is burning, and the mind are burning, just as the eye is burning. This mass of suffering, dukkha kanda, refers not to a momentary experience of suffering, but to something we amass, that we experience over time and cannot extricate ourselves from. Suffering is the fabric of our lives, as our sense of lack only grows and gnaws, and we even begin to lack kindness for those close to us, our feelings blocked, emotionally dead. We are, according to Thoreau, living a life of quiet desperation. Then, in the end, we die. But the mass of suffering does not end there. It continues to be amassed in future lives, just as it has been amassed over countless lives. It is the suffering of samsara, not the suffering of just the single life, the suffering of the ages. We will look at the implications of this in future talks. Okay, let's look at the Four Noble Truths a bit. This is grim stuff, but there is a way out. A plethora of factors is implicated in the arising of this massive suffering. What we contact in our experience and how we contact things, our affective response to what we contact, our cognitive elaboration of what we contact, what we hold dear and what we cannot stand, our views, our expectations, our habit patterns, our ego or sense of self-identity, upon which we appropriate things as me and mine, and the ways these various factors condition one another. These talks are about the range of such things and what we do about them. These talks are about the range of such things and what we do about it. Our challenge, once the Buddha's challenge, is to make some coherent sense of what we can expect to be a very complex dynamics. The most central and concise teaching about suffering that the Buddha gives us is the Four Noble Truths. The first is suffering, which is to be understood. The second is the origin of suffering, which is craving and which is to be abandoned. The third is the cessation of suffering, which is the cessation of craving and which is to be realized. And the fourth noble truth is the way to the cessation of suffering, which is the Noble Eightfold Path and which is to be developed. Each of the truths comes with a practice imperative, the final of which is to develop the Noble Eightfold Path, or simply the path. which is an outline of advanced Buddhist practice in 8 bullet points, as follows. The first is right understanding. The second is right intention. The third is right action. The fourth is right speech. The fifth is right livelihood. The sixth is right effort. The seventh is right mindfulness. And the eighth is right concentration. The path is also the way to the cessation of the entire chain of dependent co-arising. The formulation of the Four Noble Truths has been compared to a doctor's evaluation. Suffering is the symptom. The origin of suffering is the diagnosis, craving. The cessation of suffering is the prognosis. Suffering can be cured by curing craving. And the way to the cessation is the course of treatment, namely the Noble Eightfold Path. The truths also correspond to tasks taken up in practice, understanding, abandoning, realizing, and developing, respectively. Okay, I want to stop here for this week, and next week I'll discuss the Four Noble Truths in a bit more detail. We can think of the Four Noble Truths as the Buddha's first draft of the 12 links of dependent co-arising.